Hello, this is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki Balancing Form and Essence. Well, we're still on the trail of history, and this interesting dynamic, not about the actual content of the history perhaps, but what influences us in our hearing of the history. How do we take it in, and where does it go inside of us? I know that for myself and in my experience with my students, that when my students hear the history, it becomes a part of their experience of Reiki. And if there is a detail or information that's different than what they've heard or what they've understood, which often can be two different things, then there's some doubt that can creep in. And what happens when that doubt comes up and gets bigger and bigger? And I think that one of the things that's quite good these days is that we have the internet and we have these possibilities of asking questions to make sure that what we have heard or what we have understood in the beginning in our oral tradition of hearing the story, being the receivers of the story, that we actually hear accurately what's been told. You know, in the old days, and I will use that very generally, we think about the Aboriginal cultures where children heard a story, but they heard it from before they were actually verbal, from when they were just babes or maybe even in the womb. They would hear the same creation story, for instance, and they would hear it all through their lives. And as each stage of their life happened, that creation story took on a new meaning. So the listener created the whole milieu in which they took this creation story in and made it their own and also lived it and was a part of the story. And that is also true for Reiki. The process is that at this day and age, we don't often get a chance to go to a class over and over again and listen to the story over and over again in our different stages of maturity as a Reiki student. So I really encourage you to try to go back to your master or go back to some place where you can hear the story in an oral tradition now, not when you were a new student. And that's one part of listening. But then as you mature and grow as a student, including being a master, to hear another teacher tell the story is really a beautiful experience. One of the other things that I would encourage you to do is to go to Japan. And many of you, of course, as listeners, have gone. Sometimes people write to me and ask me, where should I go? What should I do when I'm in Japan? And this was always a great burning question for me. So a couple of years ago, I had this, or 3 years ago, I had this great idea, and it took me a year to kind of manifest it, to go to Japan and do a kind of exploratory tour of Japan, something that I would like to give students of Reiki if they would come with me to find the essence of Japan. And for me, this is not about visiting specifically different sites that have to do in the story, but more about the essence of the Japanese culture and what it might have been like 100 and some years ago. At the turn of the Japanese history, where they became not an isolated monoculture that was very closely held, but opened themselves to the Western world, as we would put it, and to outside influences, including Christianity and including European influence as well as American influence. And, of course, we're very familiar in the last 50 years about the advent of Japan and, of course, their introduction of their own Japanese traditions and ethics, business ethics, into our Western culture, and the mix that has happened in looking at how people conduct business, what is respectful, what's honorable, and what is not. So I have the great fortune to have three of the members of this experimental tour. With me here today, Colleen Delaney, Joyce Winnow, and Donna Stetzer. They have all been on the show before, some in the more recent past than others. But they're here to share with you their experiences of Japan. And one of the things that we did was we mostly centered around Kyoto. And I wanted them to see and to experience what I would call the feeling of traditional Japan. And the one thing that we did do in the middle of our week together, we went to Kuramayama, and the mountain that Mikao Usui went to, and they had a day there to do their own pilgrimage. And that was a very beautiful sharing afterwards, but we were all tired also. So it'll be interesting to see and to hear, their experiences and also their impressions of how this has affected their telling of the story, because each of them are masters, and also their understanding of the story and the history of Reiki. So welcome, all you ladies.
Thank you.
Hello. Thank you.
Good to be here.
And they're going to identify themselves as they speak. So I've given you a great lead-in, kind of a long one. And who would like to go first?
Do you have a specific question?
Yeah. How did your trip, or what were the impressions that your trip gave you in relationship to the history of Reiki?
Mm-hmm. I'll go first. This is Colleen. You know, just to introduce what I'm going to say, someone led me through an exercise where they had a person tell you a story, then they had them write down the story and let you read it. And there was such a huge difference. The telling of the story was so much more alive. And I have to say, the opportunity to go to Japan and to be in the area where Reiki originated, and to get a sense of the...
I will interrupt you for a minute. Originated, I would say emerged.
Emerged, thank
you. Is that a better word?
Yes,
yes. Thank you.
Right. Where it emerged, and to, as a part of our tour, have an understanding of the events and things that were happening in that era of Japan, just made it a quantum leap more alive for me. The experiences, it's very hard to describe. I would have to say that it went even deeper into my body, and I felt when I tell the story in class, it feels even more authentic. I am more authentic in the telling of it. I don't know if that makes sense. So it was even richer and more alive as a result of being there and, in a sense, walking the same footsteps up the mountain and pausing and realizing for hundreds of years this has been done. I'll stop there for a moment to give space to the other speakers. I'll come back.
Okay. Great. And in general, how was that for you?
Hi, this is Joyce. Being on the mountain for me was a really wonderful experience. One thing that really made an impression on me was that throughout the entire walk up and down the mountain, there were shrines, and many shrines. And they were Shinto shrines and Buddhist shrines. I found that to be a very welcoming feeling, and just to have that experience of the understanding of everything is important, and everything holds spiritual significance and spiritual power, because that's what I was feeling on the mountain. And to make that journey was just very special, and I especially loved going down the other side. A lot of the people that in our group went up the mountain and came down the same side. And I walked down the other side and came to another little village. And for me, that made the story even much more alive, because in that particular village, there were all the restaurants. And according to the story, when Dr. Usui came down to the mountain, that was one of the first things he did. He wanted to have breakfast after fasting for 21 days. So he picked out one of the restaurants. And that little village had one restaurant after another, still with red tablecloths on them. And many of them had women serving in kimono, I really felt, again, put back into time again to see these women dressed in traditional kimono. It was really sweet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, this is Donna, and the thing, before I actually got to Kurumayama and had the opportunity to trek, I was very impressed with the sense of honor that I got from the culture in general. And for me, that was the beginning of the deepening of the experience that I had while I was there. And I mean, my heart is racing right now just thinking about our time there. Mm-hmm. And what I find that when I tell the story now, similar to Colleen, it's not just deeper in my body, it's in the marrow of my bone and in my blood. Something happened up there on that mountain that I could connect into that very much enhanced my relationship with my practice of Reiki on all levels. So it was an experience that I think will just continue to give and give and give throughout my life. It was wonderful. Yes, thank you.
So I have had the wonderful opportunity to be on Kurumayama for 3 times. So this is my 3rd time. And I went later and took it very easy because I had needed a rest day at this point. And I went up and sat for a long time just at the top of the mountain and watched members of the group come by and in different states of connection. Some people were very talkative and wanted to visit and so on, and other people were kind of really on their own pilgrimage and in their own process. And since we started sort of talking about Mount Kurama or Kurumayama, we can stay there for a moment. One of the things that strikes me about the participants and their stories, including my own, that I've had there, has been that it isn't repeating Mikao Usui's pilgrimage. It's creating my own pilgrimage, which echoes his. And there's a part of that that's very interesting. It's like if you go to find Mikao Usui there, you will maybe find him or you won't. I mean, I think everybody has their own experience. But what happens for me is that I become a part of the story. And that, for me, is a part of the oral tradition, is becoming imbued with the energy of the story. And I'm wondering if that seems like that's true for you, and if you'd like to share anything about your pilgrimage at the mountain.
Yeah, this is Donna. I can share about that. I'll tell a little story. As I was walking up the mountain, I'm very fond of stones, and so I found myself just noticing stones, as I do everywhere I go. And I started picking them up and looking at them, and some stayed in my hand and some I put back, and I continued to walk and continued to walk. And when I reached the top, I had all these stones, and I was amazed to realize that I had 21. So,
well, that's interesting.
Yeah, I stood there and said, well, now. So I just took a moment and just sat in the energy of that discovery, and then I found myself walking toward the edge, so to speak, and I began to toss the stones. Ooh. And then I just, you know, I felt complete's not the word, but I felt as if it was time for me to turn around and go back to society. I felt round in the moment, anyhow.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I was. It was a pretty interesting experience for me.
And what about feel? So is this? I guess in doing that, then you were able to feel a part of the story. Or how would you describe that in relationship to the history?
I got the sense that it was just an opportunity for me to somehow have the story be more real.
Right.
Because I just picked up on a piece of it without intending to. You know, a piece of it came to me without any plan that I knew about.
Beautiful.
For me, this is Joyce. For me, when I'm telling the story now in class, I'm very more connected to Dr. Usui's part of it than I was before. I think just because of, you know, some of the connection that I've had in studying more the history of Japan and understanding the time that he was in when he was living there. And again, connecting with the culture and being there has put that part of the story, has given it a more of aliveness for me. I felt like before when I was telling the story, I was telling the story from what I have heard, and now I'm telling it from my own experience or from another deeper place of experience. I connected very deeply with Takata's part of the story when I got to talking about it, having lived in Hawaii for many, many years. And so now I'm also connected to this part of Usui more. And in effect, also Hayashi's part, knowing more of the culture and having experienced it and being there. So it has definitely come more alive also. And I found that in this kind of sense of honoring, and while we were in Kyoto, we did a couple of other tours, cultural tours, learning how to... we went to this really special place of this guy who has died, Indigo. And he, of course, I think is, what, a fourth or fifth generation...
Fifth generation
Indigo dyer. And also, like, even the tofu makers. This has been in their family for generations and generations. And that really impressed me. I mean, it touched me very deeply because... being an American and only second-generation American, I don't have that lineage behind me of a traditional craft or art or even culture. So being connected in that way to a fifth-generation indigo dyer or a sixth-generation tofu maker, that tofu I'm making has been made from the same family for six generations. I mean, that really puts a whole different energy and taste into the tofu you're eating. So, and also for me, when I'm gathering for my classes and I'm talking about Reiki, I feel that there's the interesting kind of place of more of a detachment, and knowing that if the person doesn't have the time or doesn't have the money, I'm so much more totally comfortable with that. I mean, it's an interesting reaction, but it's... You know, I don't look at something I'm doing wrong that I could be presenting it different. I'm so clear, much more clear than I used to be, that this, what I'm offering, this gift, this teaching, this system, is not for them at this time and place. And that they'll, they have the possibility of preparing themselves so they will be able to take the class when they're ready.
Great. Thank you. So we've opened up the scope of the experience to the other parts of the tour, and I'm just wondering, Colleen, where are you? Are you back at Kuramayama? Are you, or are you going outward? Shall we?
Well, I'm rather divided, but.
Okay, if you want to finish up Kuramayama, if you have something there, that would be great.
Well, I was very touched and became aware of the energy that that place, the land, the trees, the stones we were walking on, all held, and what a healing place it was. And I too chose to stop at every shrine on the path on the way up, and I had decided to pray or just ask about different things, and mostly about my family, my students. And then I came to one shrine, and I'd been having difficulty walking and was limping rather badly by this point of the trip. And I remember doing all of the purification and offerings first, and then I put my hands together and said, what do I need to know? And I'd had a walking stick, and at some point this walking stick fell over and went clank against the stone. And I heard this voice say, pick up your stick and walk, you don't need it anymore. And I thought, oh. And so I did, obeyed, and I noticed I no longer had a limp. I mean, it was like a spontaneous healing, and I was so grateful. And it was just struck me the power that place holds, and the impact of those who came before and their prayers and meditation somehow are held, and through those, yes, hundreds of years, the cumulative, whatever happens spiritually that the land holds is available to us all. And that really is true of the system. Mm-hmm. Through the practice, you know, the lineage, what each member of the spiritual lineage has held and nurtured and contributed, and then imagine that going out exponentially through all of their students and their practice to this gift that ultimately has been placed in our hands. And it seems to me there's this exponential piece of it. Yes, I'm an important part of the ingredient and my practice needs to be there, but there is something, I had an awareness of something much deeper. Uh-huh. That is held within the system that we all practice. It relates to Joyce's, I appreciated your sixth generation, mm-hmm. you know, indigo artist. And going to the art, I also feel that I receive so much in our experiences of just absorbing the total culture from the point of walking into the Ryokan, where we're going to stay, a traditional Japanese inn, and just seeing an alignment of house slippers in perfect alignment, and then people coming out to welcome you and take your shoes. And before you knew it, your bag had disappeared into your room. Someone had prepared the room. You know, just this total care and nurturing that I received. It was a point in my life, with things going on in my personal life before the trip, I think I was on empty before I started out, and I just felt so filled. And I feel it deepened my authenticity in some of the Japanese arts that I teach. I realized just going down to breakfast and sitting down at breakfast, there was an array mm-hmm. of dishes. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And I soon realized that it was a composition before me. Yeah. Each dish, yeah. the pottery itself, was for purpose,
yeah.
the purpose of whatever serving, whatever part of the meal was in that dish. And then I began to realize that these were dishes unique of the Kyoto area, uh-huh. And that with the seasons, the food changes uh-huh. and mm-hmm. the dishes change. And I realized this is their calligraphy composition. The cooks and the servers are offering me this beautiful composition. It was just, even, you know, everything like that just so touched me. So now I have a greater awareness of placement of things, and I did before, but it was even enhanced. And I went home from the trip and stepped into my house with new eyes and immediately decided things I was going to change and, you know, just cleared a lot of clutter, made it much more... Mm-hmm. Yeah. Give myself that environment back that allowed me to drop into this space of more contemplative, appreciative of nature and all around me. I had that to begin with, but it was just, I did not expect, because I had that, that it would be so exponentially enhanced.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's great. Thank you, Colleen. Well, I want to just give you a little bit of background. One of the things that was really important to me when I went to organize this trip is that the first time I went to Japan, I stayed in kind of low-class local business hotels. And then on the last couple of nights, I stayed in a very modern tourist hotel with that served foreign visitors and so on. So it was a hotel very much like our four-star or five-star hotels here in the States and other places. And they had Japanese-style rooms and they had Western-style rooms. So they had different toilets and they would have different beds and so on. But I was really convinced after staying in Ryokans the second time I was there that we needed to stay there because these are old traditional accommodations where you sleep on a futon on the floor. Every morning you leave and the person from the ryokan comes and folds up your futon and brings you tea on a little table, and then you're served breakfast. And so the breakfast was traditional, and myself and another member, Donna, of the group, we don't eat a lot of fish. In fact, Donna doesn't eat any fish and or seaweed. So we had a very interesting challenge for the cooks because they don't really open their grill and stuff in the morning. They have everything already cooked, and most of it's fish. So they had a bit of a challenge with us, but they did pretty well, huh?
They did beautifully.
Yeah, and we had wonderful breakfasts. They were what we would call full Japanese breakfast, which means that it was simply a Japanese meal, but a little bit less elaborate than their dinners. So we slept on futons, and one of the things that happened one day that we were in the ryokan is that we decided we all had to have Reiki. So we piled about five futons together and made this giant bed, like Princess and the Pea kind of bed. And somebody laid on these piled futons and we all crowded around and gave this person Reiki. Yeah. And luckily, because there were so many of us, there were about, I think, six of us on one person, we were able to do a Reiki treatment, a fairly good Reiki treatment in 20 minutes or so. Then we would all unfold our legs and moan and groan and roll around the floor and get situated again for the next person. So that was really interesting. And I think if I take another tour, I would create more time to do Reiki and certainly time to do Reiki on the floor. And I told everyone that they had to be able to be on the floor and to sit on the floor when we ate. So that was another challenge that we all had. And then the other part that I would like to... So I really encourage you, if you go to Japan, not to stay in Western-style rooms, but to go to the ryokan where you really have... and the traditional ones, not the ones that are meant for Westerners. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have internet service, you're going to have to find it someplace else. The people who ran this ryokan, I think this was like in their families for three generations. And it was really a beautiful place. It was right across the street from one of the big temples, the Buddhist temples in Kyoto. The thing also that really surprised me when I first went to Koromayama was that I was expecting, because of my own situation here in the United States, is that this mountain would be wild. Mm-hmm. You know, like I would go to this mountain and it would kind of have all these little woodland paths, but there wouldn't be much there. Well, you go to... you take this little funny train up to... a local train up to Kurama, and then you get out, and then there's this little village at the bottom, and then you walk up, and then there's this staircase that goes up, I don't know how many feet, and you walk up this, and then you go to there's a clog train that you can take up halfway up the mountain, or you can walk up the mountain, but there is There are buildings, there are big temples, there are small, very private little Shinto shrines. There are, it's one side of the mountain is totally what I would call populated, as it were, and built up to some extent. And that was really shocking for me. But I also realized that there is one shrine. The first time I went, and I don't know if it was still there, they were renovating it a little bit, but this shrine had been there for 1,200 years. So it was on the way back down,
yes,
kind of toward the bottom.
Yes, it's still there.
Mm-hmm. I didn't go that way when I went back down, mm-hmm, so I didn't know. But that was really impressive, and that was not the first shrine on this mountain. So you can see the experiences that people had there were about cumulative energy and cumulative lineage. And lineage is not just, a specific line that makes it correct. It's lineage as in continuum, that there's been a continuum of prayer and of thought and of thoughtfulness, mm-hmm, that have been up and down this mountain, whether it's a child or an old woman who's been there every month for, 60 years or whatever the situation is, there all these people and their steps have left a lasting impression. Mm-hmm. And this accumulation of this lasting impression really gives us something in this day and age. And I think that that's something that really gets lost when we convert this to what we would call Western culture, where, and I use the word culture quite loosely here, where the newer, the better, the more modern is the best. And this, for me, gives us a balance of that and puts us back into the story of Mikao Usui. And he wasn't looking for something new. He was looking for something from inside of himself that somehow led him to all these places to be supported in his search. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Yes.
So, whether we ever find the monastery where he went to live for 7 years, it doesn't matter.
Right.
The point is that monastery held a certain kind of energy that he needed, that he was able to step into and immerse himself into to find the sutra that he needed to find, and then to go to Kuramayama and to seep himself and to step into that environment and to create the space for him to receive the gift that he did.
Mm-hmm.
Huh?
Yeah,
that's a good way to put it. That's well put, mm-hmm, yes.
Yeah. So one of the things that we did was we went the first day I wanted to, I was really into gardens, because the first two times that I went to Japan, I didn't visit any gardens. So I was really, determined. So the first day out, we went to the emperor's palace. And this is the old palace where the emperor still actually can be in residence, but he's not very often. So you can't go inside because it's still not, common people are still not able, and of course, for sure, not foreigners, are not able to go where the emperor puts his feet. We're not able to put our feet there, but we can go along the grounds, which was really beautiful, and see the building and how it was made. And one of the people that was in our group was Shinobu Saito, who is a master that was initiated by my grandmother. She's 84. She was actually born in the United States, went back to Japan, is a survivor of the Hiroshima bomb, and came back to the United States and lived. And she added a whole dimension to our trip,
yes,
because when she went to the emperor's palace, that was one of the things that she had always wanted to do, and to be close to the emperor. So for her, that was very, very special, huh?
Yeah,
and to
yeah.
watch her in that place gave me a deeper understanding of the respect that I needed to have. It wasn't just a tourist attraction.
Yes.
It was some place to, again, step into energy,
mm-hmm,
that was specific energy.
Mm-hmm. And about lineage.
Mm-hmm. And about lineage?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh. So how was that for you, that emperor's palace? That was pretty amazing, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, remember at the very end, was that at the Emperor's Palace where all these women came all dressed?
Right. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And they were
picking out the black stones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there was this gravel, and mostly it was
white.
Mm-hmm. But there were these little black stones, and all these women, all the same size, seemed like,
yeah,
all dressed in the same little kind of working uniform. Mm-hmm. Came and they swooped down on this part of the pathway and started picking out all the black stones. And we were just like in awe.
Mm-hmm.
And they were so beautiful because it was so reverent how they were doing it. Huh?
It wasn't a job.
No.
It was a
meditation.
Yeah. It was a ceremony.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I got a sense that they held, the honor came up again for me. I saw it. You know, the threads of connection were amazing.
Yeah, and the buildings themselves, they were very basic, kind of, structurally, and old, of course, but the energy they had, again, was just phenomenal because of when people go there, they're in this honoring place, and the energy builds up again and again and again. And it was a very powerfully energetic place, definitely.
Yeah. Colleen?
I was going to just add to the honoring aspect. I recall when our group came around the corner, every one of those women stood up and bowed. And this was something impressive. No matter where we went, mm-hmm, whatever walk of life, mm-hmm, this honoring was given to total strangers.
Mm-hmm.
So on the train, when the conductor comes into the car that you're on,
he's there
with his uniform and white gloves, and the first thing he does is bow,
mm-hmm,
and then proceeds with why he's there. In a museum, you walk into another room.
Mm-hmm.
There's a docent or someone there to make sure people like myself don't take flash pictures of old things. But, but the first thing they do is, in silence, a very slow bow.
Mm-hmm.
And that giving, that respect touched me. I mean, even in modern day parts of Kyoto, it was everywhere, whether it was in a very old, revered place or an ordinary place.
Well, I remember getting on public transportation and seeing young adults or teenagers dressed in, their very modern,
funky
clothing. And as soon as we stepped on the train, they rose from their seats so that we could sit down.
Mm-hmm.
It's just part of how it is.
Yeah, I loved all the bowing, because for me it slows me down, and it puts me really in the present moment. And the conductor on the train was a very good example of that.
And I remember as I was walking up Kurumayama, and I turned a corner, and there you were.
Coming up the other side.
That
was trippy.
It was. And so, what we did,
mm-hmm,
for me it was without thinking, was to bow to one another.
Mm-hmm.
We did not speak.
Mm-hmm.
And we continued each on our path.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Beautiful.
Yeah. It was.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that struck me, I just remembered about the Ryokan, there was this honoring and respect and service that was invisible. So it was selfless. There was no need to be seen as if. As Phyllis mentioned, we'd get up in the morning and go to breakfast, and by the time we returned, our room was put in order, the futons were away. And suddenly our shoes would appear downstairs. When we came in the evening, the futons had been placed again. And always, so there was a beautiful view. Every room had a view of some kind of garden, something alive, something of nature, and also probably a scroll, or a piece of, there was a scroll, I think, in every room, and some piece of ceramic, a beautiful piece of ceramic. And throughout the Ryokan, everywhere you walk, there were beautiful spaces that had been created all around honoring ancestrally related, I would imagine, to the owners of this establishment. Mm-hmm. So, yes, it was the silence, or invisible even, mm-hmm. yet someone you had been there and served you in some way.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember realizing one day that everything that transpired was a work of art.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the, mm-hmm. the dishes and the food and the arrangement and how that mm-hmm. was in and of itself yeah. a calligraphy and art form.
Exactly.
But I think that everything that's done has this mm-hmm. reverence
yes.
to it that makes it an art form.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Living is an art form.
Yeah, that's true.
And isn't that what Reiki really gives us, is this possibility to make our lives an art form?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Some of us are a bit more abstract than others. But that's the charm of it, is that mm-hmm. it is, and their idea of beauty is very different
yes.
than the Western idea of beauty. You know, like some of the flower arrangement dishes are quite ugly, actually, looking at them, because they're lumpy and, you know, the glaze is strange and stuff. But there is a kind of beauty to them that I feel I would need to, you know, take another step into in order to get the beauty of what's really being offered mm-hmm. sometimes. One of the things that we went to, I think on the last day, we were in Japan. We were on the tour. We went to an old Zen temple that was out on the western part of Kyoto, and it was quite the taxi ride out. So we got out there, and of course we were, I think, about an hour and a half early. But we didn't want to. We went to the gate. Didn't seem open. So we went to have a little bowl of noodles, and we came back. And by the time we got back, which was about 10 minutes to the hour that we were supposed to be there, the whole temple was filled with people. So next time I go, if I go there, I will definitely go an hour early. But anyway, it was this wonderful thing where it said that we needed to, on all these tours, you need to apply and be vetted. They somehow need to have your name and address and where you're from and all that. And we went in, and there were, I don't know, how many people do you suppose in this temple?
About 200.
About 200 or so,
mm-hmm.
all.
Yeah.
But there were these little benches,
mm-hmm.
seiza stools that you have to sit in with your legs folded underneath you, and then you have this little piece of board underneath your bum. And then this little desk, and you ground ink, like in the traditional way of making ink, for Japanese calligraphy, and then we had a little calligraphy brush, and then they gave you a piece of paper, and this piece of paper had on it lines of Japanese characters that was actually a prayer,
mm-hmm.
and you were supposed to trace the prayer, the lines of the characters, so you made this prayer. Now I'm wondering if I actually did it backwards. I probably did. But anyway, did I go from right to left?
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Good, sure.
Yeah, we watched everybody else.
Yeah. So here we are, all these big foreigners. And I was also surprised that 90% of the people there were Japanese.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I thought that this would be a great place for visitors, but
mm-hmm.
it was Japanese visitors
yes.
that were there.
Mm-hmm.
So they made this prayer, and then at the very end, we were supposed to write our wish, what
mm-hmm.
we wanted, and then they would ceremoniously take the prayer, this prayer that you had just done,
mm-hmm.
and then do something with it, burn it or whatever they mm-hmm. did ceremonially. And they also chanted. And then we were able to be prepared. This was all in preparation to go into the garden,
mm-hmm.
which is a moss garden, which had something like 235 mm-hmm. different kinds of moss in it. It was a beautiful, beautiful
mm-hmm.
garden. And none of the pictures there that I took actually did it justice.
Yeah.
That's true.
So
yeah.
I took a million pictures, and I could have just left my camera at home because
you
couldn't get the energy.
Uh-uh.
You couldn't
uh-huh.
photograph what we
it's
saw.
Scintillating. Yeah.
Yeah. So that preparation, this
mm-hmm.
this understanding of how important preparation is, yes. Was so evident here.
Mm-hmm. And I remember during that preparation and mm-hmm. the tracing of the kanji, you know, I began in my left brain going, oh, mm-hmm. I don't really know how to do this. And the next thing I know was this little brush was just moving mm-hmm. almost mm-hmm. by itself as I traced this. And I got into this rhythm mm-hmm. of drawing kanji. Couldn't, yeah. had no idea what it said, but I was really yeah. connected to the act of yeah. of doing this. And yeah. it was just amazing.
Yeah, that was definitely one of the highlights for yeah. me, that trip yeah. to the Moss Garden Temple.
For sure.
Yeah.
And I'm trying now to recall the creation of the garden. Yes, you can help me with the story, but I believe, excuse me, there was a young monk, possibly in training, and he was given the task of creating these gardens. And so he designed and little by little created them. And the thing that impressed me, if I could have gone up high and looked down. And throughout the gardens there were paths and there were pools of water and mm-hmm. little streams and creeks over rocks and mm-hmm. so on. It was just beautiful. I mean, it fed every sense. But the thing that really impressed me was that if I could have been up a little bit higher, the waterways were actually forming the kanji that translates heart.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, wow. I didn't
yes.
know that.
I didn't either.
Yes. And so that just blew me away, you know. And I think of that, you know, when I sit and wow. grind ink and do yeah. sumi painting or with the assistance of a colleague who I bring over to help us learn to paint the kanji and learn about them. When I now paint heart, part mm-hmm. of me, part of my heart goes mm-hmm. back to that beautiful moss garden.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, beautiful. Mm. And
all right, so I have a question. When yeah. are we going again?
Yeah. This is Colleen.
I absolutely want to go. There's just, yeah. if you can imagine, a country that holds centuries and centuries yeah. of all that we've been speaking of. You can only yeah. touch a little of it, and so I'm ready to go back. And I would definitely stay at Ryokan's for
yes.
sure.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, yeah.
Well, I might even eat fish.
Oh, no.
It's a miracle.
All right. Well, Shinobu asked me after we got back, and we were we had another trip to Poland last year, and she said, "Well, if we go back to Japan, you can't go to Kyoto." She said, you have to go to other places in Japan. Yeah. She said, there are so many other places uh-huh. in Japan yeah. where you need to go. And I said, well, but this is, somehow, this is a city that just, that's where my attention is. And mm-hmm. I don't feel somehow that it's really about Reiki as much as it is about me. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting because I had this wonderful opportunity. Now, of course, I can't remember the name of the book, and I've given the book away. I found, by chance, this book about the cultural history of Kyoto, which was a wonderful guidebook, mm-hmm. preparation for anybody going to Japan. And I will... if you want to write me an email, if you have an idea that you might be going to Japan, I'd be glad to find the name of this book and the author and let you know. It's a fantastic book because it takes like the tea ceremony from its inception in the culture of Japan and how it emerged. And these stories so reminded me of Reiki, of some man or some group of people wanting to do something, and then this whole thing of tea ceremony emerging from this idea, and just how Reiki emerged. And I, you know, don't like to correct, so to speak, my interviewees, but that word just came to me just in the moment that Colleen spoke, and I'm not saying that she, her word was wrong, but for me, it, emergence gives a sense of something having a history even before its inception.
Agreed.
This is a part of also what the context of the history is. It's not a book that you take off a shelf and this is the beginning and the end of it. Mm-hmm. The history of Reiki really starts from the very moment in, and I think it's 700 BC or something, where Japan started and was recognized as a culture by itself, and then emerged into, and this whole stream of consciousness was behind Mikao Usui. So Shinobu once told me, she said, you know, people think that Mikao Usui was a person, and you know, the only thing they're interested in is, you know, how he discovered Reiki, but the person that he was allowed Reiki to come through him.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful, for sure.
Yeah. The person that he was, mm-hmm. with his culture, with all these lineages, with all mm-hmm. these stories, the timing of who he, when he was born and all that, came and mm-hmm. created the possibility for Reiki to come through him. Yeah. Now, you know, it's a very new concept, but imagine having a moon with no sky and no stars. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to somehow have a mm-hmm. context for what we're looking at, and I feel like this is, again, if you go to Japan, allow it to give you this context. So what I basically tell people when they say, well, where should I go in Japan? I always say, go to where your heart takes you, sit on a park bench, and watch the people. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. observe where you are. Mm-hmm. Take in what's happening. Don't worry about places to go. I mean, you can go there, but, you know, and in the end, that's only a historic, you know, sort of factual place. But what you really want is the context and the essence mm-hmm. of Japan, because it is such a different culture. Mm-hmm. Even for me, who's Japanese, who was raised in a what I would call a Hawaiian-Japanese cultural context, and I ate Japanese food and unfortunately I never got the taste of raw fish, but okay. but anyway, you know, even with all of that, when I go to Japan, it is such a different culture that I find it at once tiring, exhilarating, and confusing. Because what I imagine to be true is often not. Mm-hmm. You know, what I imagine to be important is not. Mm-hmm. You know, do we get to places on time? Well, maybe. But can we take... Do we get to places so that we are prepared to take in what the place has to offer? That's a totally different question.
Yes, yes. Exactly. Very,
yes, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Good point.
So brilliant. These are the things that I take back with me as a kind of tour guide where I don't get into, you know, berating myself for being late, but more being sure that we're there prepared to take in what we have. Mm-hmm. And one of the last things I'd like to just say about this trip is that also one of the first things that we went to was a beautiful traditional show and dances of the geisha of Kyoto. And Kyoto is the home of the geisha. And somehow we took two taxis, and one taxi left a group off at one entrance of this quarter, and then the other taxi left the other group off at the other end of the quarter. So one group was waiting for the other group, and so by the time we finally met, we barely made it into the theater at all. But the really amazing thing was that we, luckily my taxi cab was closer, and we just walked right to the theater, and we were, despite trying to look for all these other Westerners, again, this was mostly Japanese people. Mm-hmm. I mean, I mm-hmm. think there were like 95% Japanese. Yes. And of those, 80% of them were dressed in traditional formal kimono, the men and the women, and even their hair sometimes. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah. It was so breathtaking.
Like walking back in time.
Yeah. It was. For me. Yeah, and the theater is very, very old, and you sit and listen to these old, and the older geisha actually play the instruments, so you see them in their all their makeup and everything. And I just found that to be utterly fascinating. And it was, we when I got the tickets, this is quite an amusing story. When I got the tickets, the man said, "How tall are the people?" And he said, "Tall as you." Because I'm pretty tall for a Japanese person, really. And I go, uh-oh. And I said, "Well, we have two or three people much taller than me. Oh, you sit in back row." So we had to sit up in the balcony, kind of toward the back, where they put all the tall people. Because we had, Colleen is almost 6 foot. So, and she's a substantial person in the sense of energy. So we just had to sit in the back row and look down at all the small people in the bottom. It was really funny. So that was hysterical. And it was a really beautiful thing. And these dances are only done in the fall and in the spring. So just keep that in mind if you're interested in going to these dances.
And for me, personally, I felt really comfortable in that group. I mean, I didn't get that anybody was giving a stink eye because were white Westerners.
No, definitely not.
Yeah, so, you know, which is really, I think, amazing. But, yeah, it was very comfortable experience.
I felt welcome everywhere we went, even though I stood out.
Yes.
Yes, the same here. And one funny story that comes to mind, when we were in, it was in Hiroshima, I believe, there were these young teenage girls who were dressed very punk, and their hair was very punk, and I was taking pictures everywhere we went, and they were very playful with me. They'd say something and get behind me, and I'd turn, and they'd turn with me, and they, you know, it was just comical, and at the end, they just flashed me a peace sign so I could take their picture.
That's great. Yeah. That's wonderful.
Oh.
Any last words, girls? We're kind of at the end.
Yes, briefly, I really would like to acknowledge you once again for this trip and making it possible and say thank you.
Yes, me too. And also to acknowledge Shinobu-san for coming with us and sharing herself her experience of being with her on the trip was really, really special.
Yes, for sure.
Yes, I so appreciate your wisdom in today's age where everyone can go out to the web and find all these things that are not necessarily accurate, but to set that aside and not push up against it, but rather to create this immersion experience where I had the opportunity of a lifetime, really, to go to this very special place and get a sense of the time and the culture of what was going on in Yasui's day, and have that as an appreciation. And on top of that, unexpectedly, as we've been talking, what came long, long, long before him. So I do think that this is a wonderful way to allow us to have the experience by doing and deepening in these immersion experiences. And I hope you will continue to do them. And I'm sorry I missed the one in Hawaii to understand Takato's story a bit better. So it's brilliant. And thank you, thank you, thank you.
It allowed us to become part of the story.
Well, with that, listeners, we're going to close our reminiscence and our... and also our insights. I think that I've had some good insights just myself in this hour of sharing. And I want you to know that I will be doing a tour, but I can't take everybody. And I'm really willing to share my experiences, and also I want you to follow your hearts, because as Shinobu says, there's a lot more of Japan than just Kyoto, and that she doesn't mean that in any fashion that you shouldn't go to Kyoto, but that to follow where your heart leads you and to get the culture, because there's culture everywhere. I would love to, for instance, go to a city that is a ceramic city where, you know, the Raku pottery emerged and became a tradition in Japan. And there are lots of other places and lots of other art forms that can speak to you, and it really depends on you as an individual. So go not to find facts, but go to find context. And this is, for me, exactly what Reiki gives us. It doesn't give us or change the facts of our lives. What happens is it gives us a context in which to live our life as the best human being that we can be. Thank you very much. This is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence.